I want to say, first off, that I appreciate the message that Mr. Barnett gave. That was really a great message, I thought, and leads into, or, you know, lends to my sermon very well. So I really appreciated that today. Let me start off. Well, actually, let me say this. This is the third week in a row that we've given this topic of the levirate marriage topic here from Deuteronomy chapter 25. And the lever in Latin, just to remind you, means brother-in-law. So we looked a couple of weeks ago at the law in relation to the surrounding cultures to see some of the similarities and some of the differences to that which we read in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And we have found in the Bible that there are... I lost my lens. There are two practical examples in the Bible where we find anything that relates to the levirate marriage. There we go. So last week we covered Genesis chapter 38, where Tamar loses her first husband because God killed him, if you remember, due to his wickedness. So he was we don't know what that was. And then, of course, the next brother doesn't do his duty to Tamar. He's told to, by his duty, to have sex with Tamar so she could raise up seed to her dead husband. But he does have sex, but he spills his seed on the ground. And so God punished him. He was very angry for him for that. And then, of course, we see Jacob, Tamar's father-in-law, withholds his next son, his third son, from Tamar, worrying that he too might be killed. And then we say Tamar actually performing a righteous act by becoming pregnant by Judah, her father-in-law, to raise up a descendant for her dead husband. And while this may not seem like a righteous thing, looking at the story through our lens today, when you consider the cultural and biblical expectations and customs, we have to conclude what Judah himself concluded when he said, "She was more righteous than I." So this was a levirate marriage that was expanded beyond the exact literal judicial interpretation found in Deuteronomy chapter 25. You can go ahead and turn to the book of Ruth. Let me ask you a question. Has there been anything in your life that you can think of that has impacted the lives of thousands and millions of people? That you can think of things that you've done in your life that have impacted, you know, for many years to come. My situation with Carol, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have these kids if she hadn't at least said hello to me one day walking by. It was the initiative of a woman who took that upon herself for something of that nature to happen. And maybe there was some small thing in your life that you did that has impacted many, many things for years to come. What we're going to find out here today is through the story of Tamar, which I already read, and through the story of Ruth, we see acts that they've performed, that they've done, that have impacted not just hundreds and millions, but actually the whole world through eternity, what they've done. And so we're going to go through the book of Ruth. We have a little bit of time today to do this. And I want to look at this story of Ruth with you because, you know, this is a quite bigger story than we have with Tamar. Of course, we got a little bit more time to cover, but we're going to have to figure some things out from this story. Some, for instance, wonder if what we're going to read here is actually a levirate marriage or not. So we're going to have to deal with whether this is a levirate marriage, or is this more about the redemption of property? Because at the end, we're going to see property come into the story, which we won't see at the beginning. So it can be quite confusing. So I want to spend some time going over this so we can have a better understanding of the events that are unfolding in the book here of Ruth. So the account in the book of Ruth is about some 500 years after the story of Tamar. Don't really remember exactly after Sinai, maybe 200 or 300 years after Sinai when we see the law of the levirate come in at that Sinaitic covenant. But as we'll learn later on, Tamar has not been forgotten. She will be brought up in the story some 500 years later. So the story begins with an Israelite family from Bethlehem, and Elimelech the patriarch and Naomi his wife and their two sons, who were called Mahlon and Chilion, left Canaan, or they left Bethlehem, And they went to Moab because there was a famine in the land of Bethlehem there in Judah. And this was during the time of the judges. So they went to Moab, right? And while living there, we learn that Elimelech, Naomi's husband, dies. And then we see her two sons take wives from Moab. And about 10 years later, we learn that her two sons die as well. And so apparently we don't see any children from those marriages. So we have now Naomi and her two daughters-in-law who have no husbands. This is a precarious situation for widows. Three widows here we have together. And at this time in particular, marriage is very important for physical sustenance, for safety, for protection, for provision. You know, they need to be with their families. So Naomi says that she's going to go back to Israel. The famine was over. That she heard that there was bread in the land. And she tells Orpah and Ruth, her daughters-in-law, who planned to go with her originally, she tells them to not go. So look at Ruth chapter 1 and verse 9 here. She says, "The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." This means new husbands, that they would find new spouses. "And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and cried." And this surely was a very sad thing to see here. "And so they said to her, 'Surely we will return with you to your people.'" This is what her daughters-in-law said to her. Naomi said, "Again, turn again, my daughters. Why do you want to go with me? Are there any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. And if I should say I have hope, I should have a husband also tonight and also bear sons. What are you going to do? Will you wait for them until they're grown? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it grieves me so much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord is gone out against me." Now, in verse 11 through 13 here, we have an allusion at this point to a leveret custom, leveret marriage, where she says, "Are there any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands?" Now, some say that this isn't referring to a leveret marriage because if Naomi were married again, then, you know, the sons that would come from that union wouldn't be from Elimelech's line. And so that didn't fall under the conditions of Deuteronomy 25, right? And you remember the conditions in Deuteronomy 25 of the leveret. Let me just say that again in case we forgot. That if the husband dies of the wife, right? That the brother, the next brother in line, is supposed to go and take that woman in marriage and provide a seed. Of course, it goes right down the line. It specifically says for brothers dwelling together. So there are some conditions placed in that leveret law in Deuteronomy 25. So the express conditions in Deuteronomy 25 said, you know, again, the brothers live together. So we have this, I think, of a bit of a conundrum, not just in Genesis 38 with Tamar, but also for this story here. And later, as we come to the marriage of Ruth and Boaz, they don't exactly fit the model of what we see in Deuteronomy 25. And this is important because as we come closer to Ruth chapter 4, toward the climax of the story, we'll see some of this stuff come together. So look at Naomi's condition here in the immediate context of the passage. We see that Naomi is overwhelmed at what has gone on. She is... what I would expect, she feels like she's in an absolutely hopeless situation. Here in Moab, this strange country to her, with her two daughters-in-law. And she says, "Well, I'm going to go back to Israel because they have bread now. I'm going to go back to my homeland, back in Bethlehem." And she's going to go back to her family, a widow of little means, no doubt, as most widows would be at this time, and wondering, how can she help Ruth and Orpah when she can barely help herself? How is she going to do this? And so her mind is reeling, trying to figure out how to deal with all of this pressure that's placed upon her, because she feels that God has pressed his hand upon her and tried her soul. She says later, when arriving in Israel, not to call her Naomi. She says, "Call me Mara, because my life is bitter. The Lord's hand is against me." And she's hoping that the rest, or the peace, or the home that has avoided her in verses 8 and 9 would be found in the girls by going back to their mother's house and finding new husbands there in the land of Moab. And yet, as they pressed the issue with her, she alludes to the Levirate law. And maybe not in a technical way, but we see the allusion there. And she reasons with them that she's too old to have more sons. And even if, you know, she could, they couldn't reasonably wait until the boys were old enough to marry. So she wants them to go back and find peace, to find a home. Now, the reference that she says here as far as, you know, I don't have any sons in my womb. Are you going to wait till they all grow up for you to marry? I don't think we should look at this as reference as being some ridiculous or absurd statement by Naomi. Rather more as a rhetorical one, as an argument based in reality. I mean, if they could, I suppose they could wait based on the Levirate custom. So then in response, we see Orpah does go back. Right, stays in Moab, goes back to her mother's house, but Ruth does not. And we know that story very well, how Ruth clings to Naomi, and she says, I will go where you go, your God will be my God. And so they leave, and they go to Bethlehem. So now we come to chapter 2, where we're immediately introduced to a new character in the story, and his name is Boaz. And we find out pretty quickly that Boaz is a relative to Elimelech. So the barley harvest has begun, at this point where it says, and so this is sometime in late March, maybe into April. The barley harvest has happened here because you know it's going to be close to the time of Pentecost as they prepare for the wave sheaf offering. According to the law, the poor, the orphans, the widows, you know, the Bible says they have the right to glean from the fields. That is their right, and that is what God had told them to do. So the reapers were supposed to leave the corners of the field. Right. So when they reaped, they were to round the corners, leave the corners. And if they had dropped something, leave it there. Don't go back and pick it up. Leave it for those people who are poor and need help. And they will go out and pick it up so that they're the ones that are the needy. So Ruth says to Naomi that she's going to now go out and glean the fields. Naomi goes, well, go right ahead. And she's hoping that she's going to find somebody who's kind to her as she's gleaning the fields. So we have a clear indication here. So let's not think that Naomi had a lot of money. We have a clear indication that they were needy. She's going out to glean the fields. They needed to do something because they were not of means. They didn't have a lot of money. And so we know that Ruth came upon this plot of ground that's owned by, wow, none other than Boaz. Do you see the hand of God in here? That she happens to come to the plot that belongs to Boaz. Boaz wasn't there at the time, but he came later. So we have this masterful story coming together in this most interesting way. The very man who is the kinsman to Elimelech meets Ruth in the field. And after he talks to his workers about her, he comes up to her. And of course, we know that Boaz knows some information about Ruth, mostly relating to the kindness that she gave to Naomi. But we don't know how much detail he has. We don't even know that he knows that he's related to her at this point. But we do have an indication that there is some sort of interest here, some sort of possibly romantic interest in her due to his extreme kindness. So he invites her to eat lunch with him, something that might be a little unusual at the time. And then afterwards, he instructs his men something very specific in Ruth 2, verse 15. He says, when they arose to glean, or when she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves and do not reproach her. So this is something a little bit different. Let her go in and you know, basically go where she wants to glean. And also pull out some of the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean. And don't tell her not to pick them up. Now, surely Boaz was doing his part in repaying Ruth's kindness to Naomi. There's no question about it because he says in verse 12, look back up there, he says, the Lord repay you for what you have done and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So the story has this feel, to me at least, that there is more to Boaz's interest than interest in Ruth than just his kindness alone. There's something a little bit more to this. And Boaz, as we'll see, will be used by God to answer his own prayer in Ruth as it comes back to him. He asked God to take care of Ruth and Naomi. And we found out later that he's going to be the one that's going to deal with that. So because of Boaz's exceptional kindness, we see that Ruth is able to collect an entire bushel of barley. And a bushel of barley is a lot of barley. She'd already, you know, threshed it at the threshing floor, filled up this bushel of barley. I was wondering how much a bushel of barley was, so I looked this up, and one source I read said a bushel of barley is approximately 60 pounds. That's a lot of weight to carry back. I can't imagine her carrying 60 pounds back, but I guess she did. One bushel of barley would make approximately 90 loaves of bread. Now, a loaf of bread has a little over 1,000 calories in it, and if you consider in that day that about half of the calories that they ate came from bread, which I think was about right, maybe even more, then you had enough bread to sustain Naomi and Ruth for over 2 months, just from that one day. So Boaz was very, very kind to her in all that she had collected. This is quite generous of Boaz. So as Ruth brings this bushel back to Naomi, we see in chapter 2 and verse 19 that she speaks to her mother-in-law about what had transpired that day. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." And so she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Look what Naomi says in verse 20. Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said, "The man is what? A close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Now, we have an introduction to a new term here. This new term in the Hebrew for redeemers is called Goel. And you've probably heard this in the past, Goel. And Naomi is ecstatic about this Goel. She's absolutely ecstatic about it. Notice that she breaks out in praise that God has not forsaken the living or the dead. And we'll come back to that in a minute. And then the next phrase associated with that is that Boaz is a Goel, is a redeemer. Now, this term Goel throws a curveball into the text as a reader of this story. You're reading through this, and all of a sudden this term redeemer gets thrown in. And the term Goel or redeemer isn't used in conjunction with a levirate marriage. And when you're looking at this and you're saying, oh, we're talking about levirate marriage, and we're talking about the union maybe of Boaz and Ruth, because he's a near kinsman, now we have, wait, he's a redeemer too? Well, this is something different. The place where we see Goel used is in the context of property redemption in Leviticus chapter 25. And you can hold your place in Ruth, but I want you to look at this property redemption law in Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 25. God has given provision here for what happens to property when it has to be sold, or when it's lost, or when the person becomes poor. So in Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 25, it says this: "If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer," or his nearest Goel, "shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. If a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the year since he has sold it and pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and then return to his property. But if he does not have sufficient means to recover it, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his property." So we have three ways here that we learn in Leviticus 25 to redeem property so that it would stay within the family. God says there's three ways. So number one, a near kinsman can buy it. They can buy that property so it stays in that family. And that's really only if he has sufficient means to do so. If he doesn't have sufficient means, he wouldn't be able to do it. The other would be if the person who lost the property itself, you had some property, say, and you lost it, but then you were able to save some money over the years, you could buy it back. And that's the way you would redeem it. Or if neither one of the first two would happen, God says, well, eventually in the year of Jubilee, in that 50th year, the land will return to that family. It will come back. But at this point in the story, we don't see any property involved. It's not there. We don't see anywhere where there's property involved. Just the feeling that there might be something going on with the levirate marriage custom. But then we see this Goel term, this redeemer, come in, and it gets a bit confusing on what's really happening here. Are we talking about the redeeming of something, or are we talking about marriage? What are we talking about? So we need to cut through some of this to try and figure it out. So in the story so far, I get the sense that Boaz has some interest in Ruth. I get that sense. I don't know if you do, but I certainly feel that. And I also get the feeling that Ruth is somewhat oblivious to the interest that Boaz has in Ruth, and that she just feels that he's just being especially kind to her. And I also get the feeling that Naomi is the good Jewish mother who is trying to play matchmaker. We have just a classic romantic drama here. This is a great story. But behind the scenes, we see God putting the pieces and the parts together, moving about in his mysterious ways for his good purpose. Now, when Naomi says in chapter 2 and verse 20 that the Lord has not forsaken the living, Naomi is, I think at this point, feeling this troublesome pressure that she said before, with the hand of God pressing upon her and not being kind to her. I feel like this, she feels like this is being removed. Like she feels more light now, that God's hand is easing upon her, and God has not forgotten her and not forsaken her, and he's not forgotten her in the death of her husband now that she's alone, and he has provided for her and for Ruth. And then she said that God had not forsaken the dead. Now, what does she mean by that? I see it in this way, that she now sees a way for Elimelech and for Mahlon's lineage to continue through that leveret. It would seem that Boaz, Naomi envisions the lever. She thinks that he's the lever. He's going to fulfill that duty. And he would function on behalf of the dead to raise up seed to the widow Ruth, and actually to herself as well. Not just Ruth, but to herself. We don't see Naomi with any thought of redeeming property. We only see her thoughts of finding a husband for Ruth at this particular time. Now, with all of this in mind, Naomi then tells Ruth to listen to Boaz's instructions to stay in the field. Boaz said, listen, just stay in the field. Don't go anywhere else, and I'm going to take care of you. So she says, listen to what he has to say. Don't stray from the field. Don't go into other fields. Stay right there. And so Ruth did what, you know, they told her to do. She stayed in the fields all throughout the barley harvest, it says, and all throughout the wheat harvest. Now, the barley harvest, you know, runs through, at the end of May. And let's say it goes through, the wheat harvest ends about in July. So if it started in, maybe March or April, we have, about 4 months here? So we have a four-month gap in time now in this particular point where we see Ruth is probably starting to get acquainted with Boaz. We see that this is probably happening. So in chapter 3, we come to this place where a plan is being devised. Look at chapter 3 and verse 1. It says, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative? With whose young woman you were with? You see, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. So now I think we get an even clearer picture that Naomi was clearly contemplating marriage between Boaz and Ruth. And I think I would expect somewhat of a discussion between Naomi and Ruth over the intervening couple of months on this. So I don't think this was something that was sprung upon Ruth. I'm sure that they had been discussing this. What is clear, however, if it is unclear, is whether Naomi considers Boaz bound to perform the leveret. We don't see that. We're not even sure. Is he bound to perform the leveret duty, or whether she considers it to be his duty as Goel? Which one is it? Or whether she knows a marriage is not obligatory, but something which might be offered. Well, in any case, she then takes things more directly in hand in order to activate and encourage willingness on Boaz's part. This is her saying, hello. This is what I see. Remember back in Moab, Naomi said this. She said, the Lord grant that you may find a home or find rest in the house of a new husband. And in verse 1 here, we see the same remark repeated to Ruth, that she wanted Ruth to find a new home or rest for her. So Naomi was clearly thinking of marriage. This is absolutely what was on her mind. And so in preparation, Naomi tells Ruth exactly what to do, and Ruth does exactly what Naomi says to do. And look in verse 3. It says, wash therefore and anoint yourself, put on your cloak, go down to the threshing floor. Don't make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all of that you say, I'll do. I'll do all of this. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And then he came softly and uncovered, she came softly, I should say, and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. Not at his side. She was lying at his feet. And he said, who are you? And she said, I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your skirt over your servant, for you are a redeemer. So let me stop here, because there's a lot of strange things happening here. A lot of strange things that we're not accustomed to, that seems kind of odd and maybe even a little crazy. Uncovering feet of a man who's laying at a threshing floor, laying down at his feet, asking him immediately, to cover me with your skirt. What's this all about? This is a seemingly a crazy plan that Naomi had developed for marriage. Why didn't she just tell him, why don't you just go out to a movie and dinner? Maybe that would be a better idea. Maybe you can go bowling or go see a play together. I mean, that's what we typically think of as dates today, sort of that courting process. But that wasn't the custom back then. That's not the way they did things. And Naomi understood how things worked in that culture at that time. Whether or not Ruth did, I doubt. She was from Moab. She didn't understand the culture of Israel necessarily. Maybe some things crossed over. But remember, Naomi said to Ruth, he said, do exactly what he tells you to do, because she probably didn't know what to do. So whatever he tells you, do that, because he understands the customs of Israel. So that's what happened. So what I'm trying to say is all of this that happened was a direct request for marriage. This was a direct request on Ruth's part for marriage. And you think girls today are forward. This was quite the request for a proposal. Let's look at some of these things here. Widows would often typically wear their clothes of mourning until a certain long expressed period of time after their husband had died. And sometimes it's been suggested that they would wear them all the way until they found a new husband. So when it talks about her putting on, anointing herself and washing and putting on this cloak, some people have suggested this is a marriage garment. This is a wedding dress, as it were. And that's not what this was at all. I don't believe that for one single second. What might have been happening here is she might have told her, take off your mourning garments and put on, wash yourself, be clean, and put on some new regular clothing to kind of introduce yourself and open this up to him. So that's probably what that was. Some commentaries state that uncovering the feet is a euphemism for uncovering a man all the way up to his private parts. That this was like a sexual tryst that was going to happen here, and this is the way she was going to seduce Boaz. That's not what was happening here. The particular Hebrew word says uncovering his feet is only used in conjunction with uncovering the feet and the legs. That would be it. So in her case, what she came here to do was that she came and uncovered his feet and possibly his legs, not to as a way to entice Boaz, because that's not what this was particularly for. But what this probably meant, came part and parcel with laying down at his feet. And this seems likely that Ruth uncovering his feet was and laying down there was a symbol of submission. The feet is represented as a symbol of authority. It's represented as a symbol of power. For instance, Jesus, when he returns, it says his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. This is his authority that will take place, his possession of this world when he comes back. There's a reference in Ezekiel, I think, where it says the king of Tyre, and it could be Isaiah, I don't remember, but it says the king of Tyre will be trodden underfoot because the authority and the power of the nations will crush the king of Tyre. You remember Mary kissed Jesus' feet. It also says that how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace. So the foot, uncovering the foot, is opening herself up, and lying at the foot is representing her saying, I am your servant. In fact, she did say, I'm your servant. Is her saying, I'm giving you authority and power over me. And then she says, spread your skirt over me. Again, this wasn't some tryst that was going on here. This was the direct request for marriage. Spread your skirt over me. Let me give you two verses that will indicate that's what this is talking about. I'll reference Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 30. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 30. It says there that a man shall not take his father's wife so that he will not uncover his father's skirt. So the skirt is that representation of that marital union of he and his father. So you're not supposed to do that. Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 8, which is even more clear. Ezekiel 16, 8, it says, this is God speaking. Then I passed by you and saw you. He's talking about Israel. And behold, you were at the time of love. So I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. And I swore to you and entered into a covenant with you so that you became mine, declares the Lord God. So we have here a direct request for marriage, but not in an ordinary sense. It's in a relation to him being a Goel. This whole new thing that's kind of being brought into the picture, which we're not familiar with the Levirate. She says, you're my redeemer, or you're a redeemer. And so that's why this is part of the request that's coming to him. And Boaz's response is really all the more remarkable. Notice what he says in verse 10 of chapter 3 here. He says, blessed be you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness in the latter than at the beginning, inasmuch as you followed not young men, whether rich or poor. So by coming to him and doing what she's done, he didn't think that was forward at all. This was probably some sort of a customary thing that was done at this time. He calls this last kindness an act of loyalty, even greater than that which she performed when, in her commitment to her dead husband's family, she chose to leave Moab. She chose not to stay with her family, and she chose to go with her mother-in-law. And he says, it's commendable that you have done that. But what you've done now, and not gone after young men or older men, is even more commendable that you've come to me for this request. Now, there are two challenging verses in particular that I think gives one pause to consider this a levirate marriage. The first is when Naomi says to Ruth back in Moab that she is free to go back to her mother and to her mother's house and marry whomever she pleases. There were no brothers left for her to marry. And under the levirate marriage in Deuteronomy, she was only free when she went to the elders of the city. So in this case, she was free because the brothers were gone. There was no brothers left. I guess in Leverett, it would be the case as well. There's no brothers. They're free to do whatever they want. So they're not bound to anything. The other is in verse 10, where Boaz indicates that Ruth could have chosen a younger man for marriage or an older, as evident, or a richer one, poor, as evidently Boaz was probably quite a bit older. Some think that Boaz was a lot older than Ruth this time, and this is why he commends her for not going after younger men. But she didn't. She didn't go after younger men, which indicates that she had a free will to do. She could go and marry whomever she liked. She wasn't bound to Boaz. She wasn't bound to the near kinsman, which Deuteronomy 25 says you would be bound to your next kinsman. She wasn't free. In fact, it says she was not free. She had to marry the next. But in this case, she was. So we find that when Boaz says, if the closest next of kin is not willing to do the part of the next of kin for you, then as the Lord lives, I will do the part of the next of kin. So the terminology is similar to that of Deuteronomy 25, which says if a man does not wish to take his brother's life, brother's wife. So he says if the next kinman doesn't wish to do it, then I'll do it. So we see things that are very similar and things that are very different with Deuteronomy 25. Now, look at Ruth chapter 3, and let's go on verse 11. It says, and now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to you all that you require, for all the city of my people does know that you are a virtuous woman. And now it's true that I am your near kinsman. However, there is a kinsman nearer than I. Boaz is pointing out there's an order to this. And he says, stay here this night, and when it's morning, that if he will perform to you the part of kinsman, well, let him do the kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of kinsman to you, then will I do the part of kinsman to you as the Lord lives. So Ruth herself seems to, at this point, become the object of redemption, which is a little bit different now by the action of Boaz. Now we come to chapter 4. This is where the rubber meets the road, as they say. Chapter 4. And I want to look at chapter 4, and we're going to look at verse 2. Here we see that the chapter opens with Boaz at the city gate and calling the near kinsman to him. He came and sat down. So he calls the near kinsman. He come and sat down. And then verse 2, after that, he took 10 men of the elders of the city, and he said, sit down here. And they all sat down. And so here we have at the city gate, we have the introduction to one of the most detailed accounts of legal transaction in the Old Testament. Boaz has called the kinsman that is the nearest relative to Naomi, and now the elders to witness the event. So he says in verse 3, Boaz said to the kinsman, Naomi that has come out of the country of Moab is to sell a parcel of land which was our brother's Elimelech. Now, throughout the whole book until now, we don't see any mention of a parcel of land. We don't know anything about this until right now. This is the first explicit mention made of any piece of property, and it is a little bit perplexing considering that the book has been advertising marriage all along. Nevertheless, we have a deal, we have to deal with the issue of the land now that it's been introduced. Now, there are some people who feel that the land had already been sold or had already been lost, and now it needed to be redeemed to come back to the family of Elimelech, just as we see in Leviticus 25, that's explicit to that particular law. But the Bible, we also see that the Bible does not provide inheritance rights for widows, at least not in the Sinaitic covenant. We don't see that in there. However, the text is clear, I think, when you look at it, that the land belongs to none other than Naomi. She owns the land. It was to be bought from her hand. Verse 5 says so. So there are some exceptions that we do see regarding inheritance to women in the Bible. Now, we do have a reference in Job 42. You can write that down. Job 42, where we see that Job's daughters received an inheritance along with her 7 brothers. And this was probably even before Leviticus. Then in 2 Kings chapter 8, we see something very similar to what we see here. We see the land being restored to a widow after a 7-year sojourn in the land of the Philistines. There's also a reference, and I don't have the scripture off the top of my head, but there's also the reference of one of the descendants of Manasseh, I believe, of the daughters who their father had died and didn't have any sons, and they went to Moses and they said, there's no sons for the inheritance. Why should it not pass to us? And Moses talked to God. God gave an answer back to Moses. He said, yes, they're right. You shall give them this inheritance for them because there are no sons. So we do have some examples that women, and in particular, we see that widows can hold land and that not to be, that it is acceptable. So it might have been accepted by this time that the land passed from the husband to the wife upon death. We're not sure. But either way, we don't see an objection from either the elders or from the near kinsman himself that the land belonged to Naomi. So she had the rightful ownership, and the provisions in Leviticus 25 don't necessarily seem to be in effect. In other words, the land was held by her, and we don't see in Leviticus 25 the right of redeeming a land except that it had been lost. Right? So we have two things here. We have what appears to be a levirate marriage, but it doesn't follow what Deuteronomy 25 says. We have what appears to be a goel situation of redemption of property, but it doesn't follow what Leviticus 25 says either. Right? So we got to deal with this. There's a lot of wrinkles here. We see references to both, but we don't see them exactly. So we do see this. We see the goel as relating to the redemption of the land. And we see Boaz referring to Elimelech as our brother, as relating to the levirate, right here in Ruth chapter 4. I do want to bring something to your attention in Jeremiah chapter 32, because this relates to redemption of property as well, that is similar to what we see here in Ruth 4, but that doesn't follow exactly what we see in Leviticus chapter 25. Jeremiah 32, and if you want to turn there, you can certainly turn there with me. Hold your spot here, and Ruth will come back. But in Jeremiah chapter 32, we are at the place where the land was under siege, or was becoming to be under siege, and the land was going to be taken away by the Babylonians. And so at this particular point in time, we see Jeremiah and someone coming to Jeremiah. And notice what it says in Jeremiah 32 and verse 6. Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Behold, Hanamel, the son of Shallum, your uncle, is coming to you, saying, Buy for yourself my field, which is Anathoth, for you have the right of redemption. You have Golula, which comes from Goel. You are the Goel of this property, to buy it. And then Hanamel, my uncle's son, came to me," he says. That would be his cousin, right? "Came to him in the court of the guard, according to the word of the Lord, and said to me, Buy my field, please, that is in Anathoth, which is in the land of Benjamin. For you have the right of possession, and the redemption is yours. Buy it for yourself." So we have an example right here where Jeremiah had the right of Goel on property that had not yet been sold to someone else and had not been lost. You see, it's different than Leviticus. We see the same thing here in Ruth. The property has not yet been sold. So look back here in Ruth chapter 4 and verse 4. So the Boaz continues to the kinsmen and to the elders, and he says this: "I thought that I should advertise to you, saying, Buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, redeem it." So he's talking about the land of Naomi. "But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one else to redeem it besides you. You're the first in line, and then I'm after you." And so what did the near kinsman say? He said, "I will redeem it." He says, "I'll buy it." And then Boaz said in verse 5, "The day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it of Ruth, or you must also take Ruth of the Moabites, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance." Boaz says that Ruth and the land come together as a package. They come together, and you have to raise up seed for her husband. So we see a package deal that we have not seen before. This is different. And yet notice that neither the kinsmen nor the elders, again, object to Boaz's terms. They don't say, "Hey, wait. You can't do that. You can't do that. You can't say just buy the land, you know, or buy the land and Naomi, or, sorry, Ruth. Just the land. That's what you said." No, that came together. And so it says in verse 6, the kinsman said at this point, he says, wait. He says, "I can't redeem it for myself, because all mar my own inheritance. Redeem my right to yourself." So he says to Boaz, "You redeem it. I can't redeem it now. So the kinsman passes and is unwilling to perform the action of redemption as soon as Ruth becomes part of the deal. Now, there's a couple things at play here. It's possible that the kinsman was not aware of the customs at the time. I don't believe that. I think he probably was aware of the customs at the time. More likely, he was not aware of Ruth or the circumstances surrounding her. He might have not got to know Ruth or Naomi and all the circumstances of her coming back and everything that was dealing with that. He might have been in his own world in that respect. It seems odd that he wouldn't be aware, but it's only with Ruth in the deal that he passes. When Ruth comes with it, he says, no, I can't do it. Now, in Deuteronomy, if the leveret passed on raising up the seed, which he could do, by the way, he wasn't compelled, but if he wanted to pass up on that, the widow was to take the sandal from his foot in the presence of the elders at the gate, and she was to spit in his face, and a shame was to be placed on him throughout his days in Israel. We don't see this happening here. There might have been some shame that came upon him, but it's unclear. I don't get that feeling here when reading the text that there was any shame that was placed on him. What seems more likely is that the kinsman knew that if he purchased the land and children were born to Ruth, that the land that he purchased would then not be his. It would pass on to the child. That was its inheritance. Now, either the near kinsman didn't want that to happen because he was selfish, and that's a possibility, or just as likely, he may have not had the means to take care of Ruth and Naomi into his household, because it does take some effort, some means to be able to care for another family. So this could be just as likely as well. Whatever else we say, we must assume that it was necessary to inform the Goel of his marriage responsibility towards Ruth, since she made an explicit request for marriage. So I want you to notice the similarities here to the leveret at the gate in Deuteronomy 25 as we go on here. Look at Ruth 4 and verse 7. Now this was the manner in former times. Notice it says in former times, concerning redeeming and concerning changing. This is of lands. For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. A little bit different, but somewhat the same. Therefore the kinsman said to Boaz, buy it for you. And so what did he do? He took off his shoe. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, here is the court in session. You are witnesses. You are notarizing this event. This day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. So this is the whole family. He's bought, you know, everything that belonged to Elimelech and the sons, which was part of their inheritance, plus what comes with that. Naomi comes with it, and Ruth comes with it as well. Moreover, he says, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I acquired to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses to this event today. And all the people that were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman, notice what he says here, the elders say, the Lord make the woman that is come into your house like Rachel and like Leah, which did build the house of Israel, and do you worthily in Ephrathah, and be famous in Bethlehem. And let your house be like the house of whom? The house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give you of this young woman. So I want to try and put some of this together and draw some conclusions here as we wind this down. In Ruth, we see the pulling together of two statutes in the Sinaitic covenant, the leveret law and the law of Goel, or the law of redemption, not exactly as they've been written, but very similar. Deuteronomy, for instance, does not expressly require the leveret duty to be performed by anyone other than the brother. That was the limitation. And it was a brother who resided with the deceased. However, And this is the key. It does not exclude that this could be performed by a close relative either. We have to allow that the law does not stipulate the exclusive conditions for the leveret, but rather the normal and customary circumstances under which the leveret situation would operate. The same would apply then for the redemption of property as well, that it would not restrict the sale of property to a goel or to a redeemer if the property had not yet been sold. So while Ruth's story doesn't explicitly follow the legal descriptions given in Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 25, nevertheless, the actions fulfill the function of each law itself. Let me explain why I think this is the case. The basic underlying assumption to the property redemption and the leveret are found in Leviticus chapter 25. I want you to turn there. Leviticus chapter 25. There is, and Mr. Barnett went over this a little bit as well today, that in Leviticus, let me just read this, it'll make it more clear. Leviticus 25, and look at verse 38. Leviticus 25, verse 38. God says, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Two things, property and to be your Lord. In other words, God says, I own you and I own the land. I own both. I redeemed you. I brought you out. And look what he says in verse 23 of Leviticus 25. The land, moreover, he says, shall not be sold permanently. Why? Because the land is mine. The land is mine, he says. I've given it to you. So you cannot sell it to somebody else past Jubilee. It always returns back to me. So God is the true owner of the land. It is his, and he gave it to the Israelites as a possession, as an inheritance forever for them. So whatever happened, if it had to be sold, then it had to be redeemed in some way, shape, or form, that it should always go back to the family that God originally gave it to. Additionally, look at Leviticus 25, verses 55. God makes the claim on his people as well. For the sons of Israel are my servants. They are my servants whom I brought out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. You see, God owned Israel and God owned the land. And his intention from the beginning was to bring them into the promised land as the land of their inheritance throughout all their generations. And how did he do that? He did that by perpetuating the name of the families from generation to generation. You see, God didn't want the names of those receiving the promised land to be blotted out of existence. This is why he said in the leveret law in the first place that the brother was to raise up seed from the wife. Why? So that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. But in the leveret, the deceased could only be revived in both person and in property. It had to come together. They could only be revived in person and in property. In cases where the widow had no children that was connected to property, which was in danger of being lost due to poverty, the deceased's name was not merely revived through the birth of a son. That alone does not suffice. That alone does not cut it. The son alone did not fulfill the intention of what God had in plan for them. It was also through the redemption of the property owned by his ancestors as well. It came together. You see, if the near kinsman to Ruth had redeemed just the land and not married Ruth, the land would be lost in perpetuity to the line of Elimelech. He wouldn't have anything. The inheritance that God gave them, it would be gone. But what if the near kinsman redeemed the land and Boaz married Ruth? Well, then the inheritance of the land and the person would be severed. They would lose it as well. So the obligation was that the inheritance and Ruth came as one unit, indivisible, to connect the family to the land and keep the inheritance with the name that should not be blotted out in Israel. And I love the scripture that Mr. Barnett read in Psalm 37, that the righteous shall inherit the land and dwell in it forever. It's part and parcel. They come together. There is no contradiction in the laws as we see them. What we see in Ruth, rather, is the administration of the spirit of the law in action in both Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Ruth is the application and the practice based on the law of love. And that's what it comes down to. It was the law of love. Let's remember this, that laws are not meant to restrict good behavior. Sometimes this is confusing. We think that if the law doesn't say something that I should do something, then we don't do it. You know, if I have a property law here and it tells me what I can't do, it doesn't necessarily. So sometimes you think to yourself, well, it doesn't tell me I should do that, so I'm not going to do it. That's not what laws are for. Laws are meant to restrict bad behavior, and the expansion of them is based. They're not to restrict good behavior, right? That's not what they're for. They're to restrict you from bad behavior. If you want to expand upon it, it's because there's an expansion and understanding of the purpose of it. Laws are based on love. They're based on relationships, on telling how we're supposed to behave with others. So the fullest expression of the law of God would be to say, how can this law be expanded for what I can do for others? This is exactly what Jesus said in the New Testament. He expanded. He said, you know, you've heard this in old times, but I tell you this. This is really what it means. Don't just restrict yourself here, but do this. And we had a whole sermon series in the Ten Commandments by Mr. Robinson here a few years ago. And he laid out very clearly that even though there was restrictions in the law, what it's saying is don't do this, but do other things. Do the good things. This is what the law is for. And so this is what it's here for. So we see the actions of Tamar and Ruth were actually actions of loving kindness. Ones in which they were concerned for their family names, that they would not be blotted out in the land of Israel, and that their family legacy would go on. And God rewarded them in such a way that the promises given to Abraham many years ago in Genesis, right? We just heard about that, would go on. And they would surely come to pass. You know, Mr. Dobson has been talking about the lost tribes over the last, three or four weeks now. And what I've been talking about these last 3 weeks has direct bearing on his messages as well. You remember that in Abraham there was the dual promise, the promise of one seed, the Messiah, the salvation and grace that we see in the scepter. And we see that in Judah. The scepter, he says, will not depart from Judah. And then there was the second promise of the birthright blessing, the national blessing of greatness given to Joseph, which was given to his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, when Jacob crossed his hands on them. And both of those promises resided together under a unified Israel for a period of time. But when the kingdom was eventually split in two under Rehoboam and Jeroboam because of what Solomon had done, the birthright went to the northern tribes and the scepter stayed in the southern tribes. And captivity eventually came to Judah after it had come to the northern tribe of kingdom of Israel. And Judah was taken captive around 586 BC. And in order to keep a descendant on the royal throne of David, it was necessary that Jeremiah had to flee. And we learned about this from Mr. Dobson. He had to take the daughters of Zedekiah and they fled to Egypt. Right, and then eventually they went up to Ireland and to Scotland and to Britain. And this comes back to the line of Phares. And we've talked briefly about this, but do you remember that Phares and Zerah were born to whom? Tamar. Tamar and Judah. There was a breach, though, these twins. While in labor, remember, Zerah reached his hand out and he had a scarlet cord tied around him to signify him as the firstborn. But he pulled it back, and then lo and behold, Phares comes out before Zerah. And the midwife says, "What is this you've done? A breach be upon you." And so they called his name Phares, meaning breach or division, because he came out first, which he shouldn't have. And so it created this breach that we've talked about for years and years between Phares and Zerah. And then that division was then used by God to continue the throne of David through Ephraim. You see, not only did Tamar's loving kindness bring about the birth of the twins that were ancestors of the Messiah, but they were also used to keep the throne of David alive and well. And you remember that Mr. Dobson was talking about how Tia Tefi, who was the daughter of Zedekiah that Jeremiah took with him to Egypt and Bethlehem to Ireland, was also called Tamar Tefi. How interesting. Their name was Tamar Tefi. And that when they went up there, she was the throne to the heir of David. She was the one that kept this alive. And then when they went to Ireland, she was married to King Hermon, who was a descendant of none other than Zerah. So we have the descendant of Perez in Tia Tefi, the descendant of Zerah in King Hermon, who now came together, who Zerah was the true firstborn, and the breach was now healed, and the throne of David was safe until the return of Christ. Ruth's loving kindness was used as the line to spawn the house of David, as we know that Obed, which is short for Obadiah, would beget Jesse, and Jesse in turn would beget David. So you see, God's faithfulness is exemplified and borne out in these women, even for us today. What they did because of their concern for their family and for the continued lineage of not only person but property came together through those laws to affect you and me today and all of humanity. God's desire is strong for his people. His desire is that his chosen ones will not be forgotten, that they should be saved and lived eternally, and that our names would not be blotted out, as it says in Revelation of the Book of Life. But not just that alone. It's also that God has reserved an inheritance for us, this great universe that can never be taken away. It can never be lost because his son, Jesus, is our Redeemer and our Goel. And in our debt and loss, in our sins, he brings us back, forgives us. He gives us life eternal, and he gives us an inheritance, both together. He brings them back together in the perfect harmony and unity that was always intended. You see, the law of the levirate and the law of redemption is seen in action through the actions of Tamar and Ruth, of which we are all been the great recipients of those two great women's loving kindness. Thank you, sir.